Akoten Erev Shabbos, everyone. We're about to begin Be'ez Hashem, Shir number 198, Witorsky's book, Life's Too Short, about self-esteem. He talks about why often we resist our own self-awareness. Many people who have a negative self-image have a reluctance about discovering their true selves. They're convinced that if they try to discover themselves, they'll only see negative aspects of their personality. So they're very afraid of looking at this. You know, when we talk about cheshbon hanefesh, right? We have to look at all the chametz in us and all the negativity in us. And, you know, there is a place for that, to look in, you know, to see what we need to correct and see the ugliness inside that we didn't realize was there and to uproot it and all that. But we don't see the beautiful side of it. Of seeing the beauty and the potential within us, our holy neshama within us. That's also part of self-awareness. That's also part of cheshbon hanefesh, the positive. Now, it is true, there are many things in the past that we may not be proud of, but that should not hold us back from self-discovery. We talk about it, we learn from it, we could then remove those negative things in the past. Tshuva uproots things. But we should not try to resist the self-exploration that will heal us and bring us out of many unhealthy things. So sometimes you resist self-exploration because you're afraid of finding more character defects. But very often, it's very strange, but very often people are afraid of self-exploration because they are reluctant to find their virtues. They don't like to see even their personal assets. He says a very sad story. There was a 23-year-old woman that was admitted to treatment for a drinking problem. And at the admission interview, she asked whether she would undergo psychological testing. He says, why do you want psychological testing? And she says, I'm afraid I'm brain damaged from the drinking. And Rabbi Witorsky was an expert. He knew, don't worry, you have no brain damage. No need for psychological tests. And she again the next day said, you know, could she have a brainwave test? And he said, there's no need. She said she wanted a CT scan of her brain. And Witorsky kept on telling you, I already told you you have no brain damage. She says, how are you so sure? You don't know how much I drank. And her inability to accept that reinsurance was very puzzling to Witorsky. But then after a long interview, Witorsky realized what it was. She actually wanted to have brain damage. She wanted to have brain damage. That way she could tell her family, you know, leave me alone. I'm not capable of achieving sobriety. Recovery from alcoholism is difficult enough in normal people, but I'm brain damaged and I can't be expected to overcome my addiction. Right? Same thing if they want her to keep a job. What do you mean? Keep me, hold a job? No, I'm brain damaged. You know, go to school, college, impossible. I'm brain damaged. You know, as tragic as brain damage is, it would have been a perfect out for this person. It would exempt her from any efforts to remain sober and from any efforts to improve her life. So we do this often. You know, I'm an anxious person. I'm damaged goods. That's it. There's nothing I could do about it. I can't cope. And you exempt yourself. It's a strange kind of comfort when we resign ourselves to that state of inadequacy. Because then we are exempt from trying. Why try? Why bother trying? And this is why he talks about that encouragement and support when you have these groups that do that in a healthy way. It's very, very helpful. But this concept of being afraid to move forward and rather stick to a deficiency and not bother to grow is a very big yetzahara for these people. So for example, there was one person in group therapy said that their performance deteriorated recently because they had anxiety over impending promotion. You know, when you get elevated to a more supervisory position, then you worry, do I have that capacity to supervise? And the worries about disappointing everyone, the worries about failing in this new position. So it's an understandable fear. But sometimes the fear is so strong that, you know, you convince yourself that you're not, and psychologically maybe that he's doing less of a job now because he wants to, in a weird way, convince his superiors, I'm not capable of taking this promotion. Retract this promotion. I can't do it. Right? So it's easier to do that than to go forge ahead. So that's a very, very important thing. At the end, this person accepted the promotion and performed very well in that position. But that pervasive trait of wanting to self-sabotage that way is very common. Growth is out of the comfort zone. It's somewhat painful. Yeah, there are times where you bite off more than you can chew, and that's an issue. You know, you have to know what you really can handle. But very often you can handle it well. It's just that you're afraid. And it's normal, but you'd rather have that sense of, no, I'm not capable, no, I'm brain damaged, no, I'm whatever, in order to not have that growth. And that's something we need to be very in touch with. So this is one of those examples of why we're resistant to self-awareness and how we have to go and combat that feeling. Another aspect that's very, very important is to get in touch with feelings. Now, maybe these days people go overboard with getting in touch with feelings, but very often we disown our own feelings when we consider them not proper. We're afraid we can't control them or they're too painful. So here is an example that Rav Twersky says, an incident that took place regarding this. He says, one day my wife pointed out to me that the faucet on the laundry tub was leaking. When I tried to turn the valve to cut off the water flow, I was unable to do so, and I had to call a plumber. The plumber was no more successful at it than I was, and he explained that the valve was frozen in its position and probably had not been touched since the house had been built 70 years earlier, and the only way to fix the faucet was to turn off the main valve that controlled the water flow to the entire house. After the water was shut off and the faucet dismantled, the plumber confronted me with the sad findings that the entire interior of the faucet was eroded and the unit had to be replaced. After the work was finished, the main water valve was turned on. And I discovered every time I turned on the faucet in the house, there was an initial explosive discharge of rusty water, which gradually became a smooth, clear flow. So remember this mushroom for a second. The following day, I saw a young man in consultation. After 2 weeks of intensive group therapy, Joshua appeared to be detached from all feelings, showing no emotions. During the interview, it emerged that when he was 10, his father suddenly died. He recalled looking at himself in the mirror and said, I'm not going to cry. And indeed, he did not cry. It became evident that at age 10, Joshua had tried to shield himself from feeling grief. Not because he was unable to find a way to turn off this specific feeling. No, rather, he was unable to turn off that specific feeling. So what he did was, is he turned off the main valve, so to speak. He shut off all his feelings. So not only did not experience the grief and the pain of grief, he became insensitive to all emotions, and as well as happiness, or as well as sadness. So since at age 10, he felt no anger and no pride and no love and no joy. Now, he now was confronted that in order to experience feelings, any feelings, he has to open up the main valve, like in the muscle that he gave, the analogy, right? And now he felt that the emotions will overwhelm him. You know, like opening up that faucet, it'll follow with an explosive charge of rusty water initially. He was frightened of the joy or the pride or the shame or the sadness that he would feel. But once Rabbi Twersky explained this phenomenon to this Joshua, he understood it and he allowed himself to relax his guard. And his group provided him the necessary support to him carrying out the initial feelings of emotions that he started to feel. So you see here why someone would want to avoid painful feelings. And many people use these mechanisms to protect us from this emotional stress. So, you know, as an example, one time, also Twersky has this poignant story. A young man asked to speak to him privately, threw his arms around him and began to cry and said, you have to help me. I can't take it. I can't take the pain. You know, he was 23 years old, was using drugs since he was 14. Now he's on detox. And Twersky asked him, from the time you began using drugs until now, what was your longest period of abstinence? He said he didn't have any. This is the first time that he stopped for a while. So Rotorsky told him about a young woman who had been involved in a serious automobile accident and many fractures, had no sensation and motion in her right arm. The neurosurgeon performed nerve repair, but he said that there's no guarantee that she'll have feeling. You have to wait 3-4 months after the operation to see if the operation was successful. And now after 3 months, she smoked, and she dropped a lit cigarette on her left hand, and it fell into her right hand, and she felt pain. When she felt the pain, she jumped up and down from joy, running around the room, screaming happily, It hurts, I feel pain. So this woman, whose hand was paralyzed, the pain was an indication that the surgery was successful, so she was joyful from the pain. The distress of the burn was paled in significance to the good news that her hand was functional again and it was going to be used again, and the use of her right hand was more joyful and overrode the pain. So Rutorsky told this person who was in recovery from drug addiction that for 9 years he basically deadened, like anesthesia, deadened his brain with chemicals and felt no sensation, not joy sensation, not sadness sensation. And paralyzing the brain with drugs basically blocked his personality development. And now that the drugs were out of his system, so now his capacity of feeling was returning, and he's able to grow, and he's able to mature, and therefore there is a painful aspect to that. So Rutorsky tried to empathize with his suffering. It's rough that you're suffering, but there's a positive effect of feeling again that should try to outweigh that pain. You know, I'm depressed. Be sad that you're happy that you're feeling that sadness. Just like that woman who danced with joy when the cigarette burned her right hand and felt the pain. See, because, and the idea really sadly is, you know, you could say, what does addiction have to do with me if you're not, you know, susceptible to this? But chemicals are not the only way we deaden our feelings. Our unconscious mind often tries to shield us from distress. And it takes a lot of effort to overcome these natural protective maneuvers that we do. And therefore, we have to really work hard to be committed to allow ourselves to discover ourselves, even if they are painful feelings, and to let it out and to heal from it. And ultimately, you'll be a source of joy, even though right now it is painful. And this is the process sometimes of the guilt we feel with tshuva and all that. It can't drag us down. We can't get depressed from it. We use that pain as a vehicle for growth and ultimately for a true joy and a true simcha. Bracha v'hatzlacha.